Good morning, Your Honors. Today, I'm discussing the response to the motion to dismiss that was filed by Ronald Woodson Mecklenburg on behalf of Deutsche Bank to dismiss this appeal as being not moot at this point.
Excuse me, could you just state your name for the record?
Sure. Please? It's Rolf von Merbelt, 41533.
Thank you.
The primary argument, as I understand it, is that the foreclosure action, notice of election, and demand that prompted the filing of this lawsuit and a motion for preliminary injunction was withdrawn after the appeal was perfected in this matter. I've got documents here showing that it was in fact withdrawn on November 22nd, 2012. The appellant's brief, our brief, was due January 22nd, 2013. Obviously, I had no idea prior to the filing of that appellate brief that the foreclosure action had been withdrawn. I've got a copy of the notice of withdrawal from the public Denver Public Trustees website. It was in fact filed by Ronald Woodson Mecklenburg, the same firm here today. it was never brought to the attention of this court, obviously, until very recently, until about a week before this appellate argument. Of course, the parties had to incur substantial attorney's fees in the meantime, appealing this action, which I believe if the court is going to grant the motion to dismiss, Mr. Williams should be entitled to recover some of his attorney's fees, since all this issue could have been avoided if the court had been put on notice back in November of 2012.
So, counsel, one of your concerns is attorney's fees are reaching the merits. Is the case in fact moot at this point?
No, it's my position that it's not.
Why not?
Because the issue, first of all, the underlying lawsuit is still outstanding. We have breach of contract claims, Colorado Consumer Protection Act claims, negligent misrepresentation claims against Deutsche Bank. The reason we filed a motion for preliminary injunction was to prevent any foreclosure sale from occurring throughout the course of that proceeding, to maintain the status quo concerning the property, that Mr. Williams maintains title to the property until that litigation is finalized and completed.
Mr. von Merbelt, let me just follow up on Judge Roman's question. If we were to conclude that the appeal is moot, that would only apply to the appeal of the denial of the preliminary injunction. The underlying case would still be in a position where it may or may not be litigated.
Right, but Deutsche Bank will be free to initiate a new foreclosure action, a new Rule 120 action, at any time, commence a new foreclosure sale date. In fact, this is what happened immediately after they withdrew the first foreclosure sale date in November of 2012. A different law firm on January 31st, 2013, filed a new Rule 120 action seeking to get a new foreclosure date. I had to send them a threatening letter informing them that there's a stay at the district court while this appeal is pending, which prevents any further disposition of the property. At that point, they withdrew the foreclosure action. But if this court dismisses this appeal, then Mr. Williams has no recourse during his underlying litigation to seek further court relief to prevent another foreclosure sale from going forward. So to me, it's not a moot issue. Deutsche Bank can initiate a new Rule 120 action at any time, unless this court reverses the district court's order and instates a preliminary injunction during the course of the litigation.
So if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting to us that the case may not be moot because of it would be under the exception to mootness of capable of repetition yet evading review.
I think that's fair to say. What I'd like to direct the court to is the purpose of a preliminary injunction primarily is to maintain the status quo throughout the pendency of the litigation. If there is no preliminary injunction issued in this case, Deutsche Bank is free to start a new Rule 120 action, order a sale date, and Mr. Williams has no recourse. There's nothing he can do. It's this court's decision in this case, which is currently at issue, that's going to determine whether he's able to keep his property throughout the underlying litigation without having to deal with another foreclosure sale date.
Well, let me ask you this. To what extent do you think that the issues that you're raising on appeal now on the merits would be the same if there were a new Rule 120 proceeding filed?
It has nothing to do with that. The issue is whether a preliminary injunction should have been issued by the district court, whether the district court properly applied the law in denying the preliminary injunction, whether there was a reasonable probability of success on our claims to merit a preliminary injunction to maintain the status quo throughout the pendency of the lawsuit.
But presumably, at least some of the circumstances surrounding any new Rule 120 proceeding would be different. For example, it's my understanding that there was a notice issue in the prior Rule 120. That may not be the issue in a subsequent 120 proceeding.
That may be possible. I don't know how the bank is going to, I assume they'll go through the procedure, the proper procedure of notifying my client of a new Rule 120 proceeding. But the fact of the matter is it doesn't have anything to do with this appeal. This appeal concerns the denial of a preliminary injunction, which we sought to maintain the status quo of the property, title, and Mr. Williams' name throughout the pendency of the lawsuit. It's our position the court improperly used the findings at the Rule 120 hearing to deny the preliminary injunction when that is in fact not the law. The law is whether there's a reasonable probability of success and the five other Rathke factors on whether my client is entitled to a preliminary injunction during the pendency of the lawsuit.
Mr. Von Mirveld, I see that there are ad hoc procedures that have already fallen by the wayside because we spend more than 5 minutes, but that's because we've asked you a lot of questions. So I think we should hear from your opposing counsel now.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Lisa Cult, Attorney Registration Number 43054, appearing on behalf of Deutsche Bank National Trust Company. Your Honors, I had filed this motion when taking over this case in preparation for oral argument. When I had taken it over, it was already fully briefed. And at that point in reviewing it, it came to my attention that the foreclosure the foreclosure itself had been withdrawn, and the motion for an order authorizing sale in the Rule 120 proceeding had been dismissed. Now, as this, the preliminary injunction sought by Mr. Williams in this matter specifically related to staying that foreclosure, it seemed to me that this issue, as it relates to the appeal, is really moot. Here, Williams is attempting to enjoin a foreclosure sale, which has been withdrawn. And a court, it's clear, a court will only invoke judicial power when there's an actual controversy, which exists. You know, as the foreclosure sale is no longer pending, there doesn't seem to be a present basis for a preliminary injunction, and there doesn't seem to be any controversy for which the court can rule upon. And I think this is sort of shown by that even if the court here concludes today that the trial court committed reversible error in denying the preliminary injunction, there's no foreclosure sale to enjoin any longer. Nothing is pending.
Ms. Cobb, what is your response to Mr. Von Mirveld's concern that if we were to dismiss this appeal as moot, that the next day another Rule 120 foreclosure proceeding could be filed against Mr. Williams?
Sure. My response is that if that in fact would happen and a new foreclosure is initiated, then Mr. Williams would at that point have an opportunity to respond, because he would be provided notice of the Rule 120 proceeding. He could respond there. He could also come back in this case, in which there are six additional claims pending, you know, which would then come off of stay and proceed, and seek relief or another stay in the district court, you know, based on the new facts which came to light, based on the new foreclosure filing. It seems so many of the issues, you know, for which we're here today are specific to the 120 case that happened in this instance. You know, a new foreclosure would obviously give him a new opportunity to respond, and may not involve the issues here, which are really specific to that 120 case.
Do you know why the rule 120 foreclosure in this case was withdrawn and dismissed?
I do, Your Honor. Under Colorado law, a foreclosure has to be commenced within a certain amount of time after the notice of election and demand is filed, and when the stay was entered at the trial court level, we've reached the point where that mark period, so we could no longer proceed, and the foreclosure would have to be withdrawn and restarted. So that was why the foreclosure was withdrawn. And I believe counsel for Mr. Williams was, to some extent, aware that the foreclosure was withdrawn, and I only bring this to the court's attention based on his request for attorney's fees, because he mentioned to me that he was aware that it was withdrawn, and also that another firm had tried to restart the foreclosure, so it was certainly had an opportunity at that point as well to bring it to the court's attention. If I may briefly touch on the mootness argument once more. With respect to the exception to the mootness rule, which Mr. Williams seems to point to, which is where cases are capable of repetition but evading review, in such cases, the issue has to be of great public importance or of a recurring constitutional violation. Here, even if the issue was capable of repetition, is not of great public importance. Specifically, this foreclosure refers to issues involving a note in a deed of trust, specifically with Mr. Williams and Deutsche Bank. So I don't believe that there is a public importance to that issue. In light of that, I would ask that the court grant the motion to dismiss this appeal as moot.
Thank you, Ms. Culp. So I think now we'll proceed with our oral argument on the merits. Okay. And so, Mr. Von Mirveld, you're back, and so you have 10 minutes now. Sure. Even though you went over 5 minutes, we'll give you a full 10 minutes for great discussing the merits.
I'll reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. And before the clock starts, because this is an unusual procedure, I do have a rebuttal kind of question for you. You heard the opposing counsel say with regard to why you would not be entitled to attorney's fees, that you were aware that the foreclosure had been withdrawn. Can you address that?
Yeah, I wasn't aware until Mr. Williams contacted me, said he received a new notice of a new Rule 120 action from the Baden law firm, which was an entirely new law firm. So I called them up to see what was going on. They said the previous Rule 120 action had been withdrawn. This was on January 31st, 2013. 10 days after I had, or 8 days after I filed the opening brief. Okay. So it should also be noted. So that's when I first learned. That's when I started going through the Denver Public Trustee records to find out what the heck was going on with why there were two Rule 120 proceedings now, and it became apparent that the first one had been withdrawn.
And what was the date of the dismissal of the Rule 120 proceeding?
November 22nd, 2012.
And why wasn't Mr. Williams or you notified of the dismissal of that Rule 120 proceeding?
I have no idea. I didn't receive anything. He didn't receive anything either. It was submitted to the public trustee's office only. That's where I got the document. That's... If I can file a response to the motion, I'll include all those documents with my response. So, to begin with, I want to make clear that there's a distinction between what a Rule 120 action is and what Mr. Williams was actually seeking. He's seeking a preliminary injunction against Deutsche Bank, okay, and the public trustee from doing anything with his property during the pendency of this litigation. I think that's significant because the injunction, the party being enjoined, would actually be Deutsche Bank from proceeding with any new foreclosure action. That's another reason that this is not moot, in my opinion, and you don't even have to go the extra step to the cases involving evading review and repetitive. I assume the court's read the transcript and the court's findings. Obviously, our issue with the district court was that they relied almost entirely on the Rule 120 judge's findings at a purportedly a Rule 120 hearing, which was not held, Deutsche Bank's motion for a rule, an order authorizing the sale of the property was held, was issued without a hearing. And the district court judge in this case, after the preliminary injunction hearing, seemed to give preclusive res judicata effect to the Rule 120 action, which is specifically barred by the express language of that rule, and all the authority in Colorado, including United Guaranty Residential versus Vanderlyn, which states very clearly that a Rule 120 proceeding is not final, not preclusive, has no res judicata effect. The court, in fact, made some very clear statements that she was bound by the Rule 120 court's finding, and that there was nothing that we could do to, that that was the law of the case, the rule of the case, there was nothing that we could do in seeking a preliminary injunction to overturn that Rule 120 court's finding. Well, as this court's aware, that's not the legal standard for preliminary injunction. The legal standard is the Rathke versus McFarland factors, which are six factors in the 1982 case. The court made some ancillary findings concerning those, but she basically ignored the claims in our complaint and did not make any specific findings as to whether there was a reasonable probability of success, which is the primary factor under Rathke, of our claims in the complaint.
Mr. Van Mierveld, I believe the Deutsche Bank in its brief suggested that there were alternatives to seeking a preliminary injunction in the 120 case, like filing a motion for reconsideration or challenging it through a Rule 21 proceeding to the Supreme Court.
Well, if I can read the actual language of Rule 65, or Rule 120, expressly recognizes the right to seek injunctive action, regardless of what the Rule 120 court has issued. And so that's precisely what we did. The important thing, the most important thing to note, is that Mr. Williams proved a large deal of his breach of contract claim in particular. And what I'd like you to look at is Exhibit D, which was the trial period plan agreement, 2009 trial period plan agreement. The court and Deutsche Bank made some kind of ancillary arguments that that agreement was barred by the Colorado Credit Agreement Statute of Frauds and therefore could not be enforceable. Well, they admitted a copy of that 2009 trial period plan modification agreement signed by a Deutsche Bank's representative. The signature is on the back of the document. It's Exhibit D in this appeal. That right there takes that agreement outside the statute, the Credit Agreement Statute of Frauds. So any claim relating to that agreement, and based on Mr. Williams' testimony and the agreement itself, in fact, supported a more than just a reasonable probability of success, but a very strong possibility of success at trial. And the court really just completely ignored that evidence and said improperly relied on the Rule 120 findings. I believe completely ignored the 2009 trial modification agreement and just glossed over the requirements that she's supposed to make under Rathke in determining whether preliminary injunction is merited.
What is your response to Deutsche Bank's argument that the trial period plan agreement was really an agreement to agree and not really a separate contract?
If you can look at the express language of it, it is an express separate contract. The first paragraph states, just 1 second. If I am in compliance with this trial period plan and my representations in Section 1 continue to be true in all material respects, then the lender will provide me with a home affordable modification agreement as set forth in Section 3. Okay? Well, that's pretty clear contractual undertaking from Deutsche Bank to modify the loan provided that Mr. Williams complies with the terms of this agreement. It's interesting, this agreement states on its face that it's not effective until Deutsche Bank signs it. If you look at the date, they didn't sign it until 10 months after Mr. Williams sent this agreement in. frankly, I've done about 20 of these cases. This is the first trial period plan agreement I've ever even seen signed by a bank. Typically, they never return the agreements to the homeowners. If they try to sue to enforce the agreement, then they're barred by the Colorado Credit Agreement Statute of Frauds because they don't have a signed writing. We were fortunate in this case that Deutsche Bank presented the signed agreement in the preliminary injunction hearing, which met the threshold for the Credit Agreement Statute of Frauds. So we can maintain any claim related to this agreement. But this is clearly a contract. The other issue that's important to know about this agreement, and it says it within the terms, is that by reducing the monthly mortgage payment in this trial period plan agreement, Mr. Williams is continuously falling further and further into arrears, because a full loan mortgage payment is not made until there's enough money in the escrow account to make a full mortgage payment under the existing note and deed of trust. So if you can look at the signature on the back of the agreement, they didn't sign it until 10 months after the fact. By its own terms, it's supposed to be a 3-month agreement. So for 10 months, Mr. Williams is paying $806 a month. He's falling further and further into arrears on the existing 2007 loan modification note, which by the bank all of a sudden saying, we're not going to honor this agreement, providing no reason other than the fact that they will not approve a second loan modification agreement, period. Then all of a sudden, Mr. Williams is more than 10 months behind in his mortgage payments because he's complied with the bank's trial period plan agreement. I don't know if that makes sense to the court, but that's the problem with these agreements, is that it's actually causing the homeowner who's doing exactly what the bank is telling them to do and paying the reduced amount with a promise that if you comply with this, provide all the documentation, we will permanently modify your loan. All the while, they're falling further and further behind the existing loan obligation, which makes it next to impossible for them to catch up eventually.
Mr. Van Meerhout, you have a little less than 2 minutes left. If you want to reserve your time for rebuttal.
Yeah, I'll reserve it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
And counsel, before the clock starts, I want to ask you a question related to the mootness issue. Your counterpart says that neither he nor his client ever received notification after the November 22nd, 2012 withdrawal foreclosure. Do you have any evidence to the contrary of that?
I don't have any evidence to the contrary. And in fact, I asked my opposing counsel, because she's handles more so foreclosures versus myself, who handles litigation. But my understanding is that when a foreclosure is withdrawn, the public trustee is advised that the case is just dismissed and there isn't formal notice that is sent. That is my understanding this time. I'm happy to submit separate to research the issue within my firm and submit something if the court would like. But that's the best answer I can provide at this point.
Well, hey, did your law firm participated in the Rule 120 proceeding?
They did, Your Honor. Our law firm was counsel for Deutsche Bank in the 120 proceeding.
Did it not occur to you or anybody else in your firm that it would have been prudent, if not necessary, to advise either Mr. Williams or his attorney that the Rule 120 proceeding was being dismissed, especially in light of the pendency of this appeal?
Your Honor, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. Yes, it would have been prudent and appropriate to advise him. I can't answer as to why it didn't happen. I can only apologize to opposing counsel and the court, and that as soon as we realized that it had happened, I contacted opposing counsel to advise him, and it seems that he was already well aware of that fact.
So the attorney working on the case leaves the firm, but the case stays with the firm, correct?
That is correct.
So wasn't it assigned to another attorney right away?
It was assigned to an attorney, and it was reviewed, but it was also seen that it was fully briefed, for oral argument, and that attorney would pick it up to prepare and review it in preparation for oral argument. And at that point, that is when I went back and noticed that the foreclosure had been withdrawn.
Apparently you didn't notice that until after Mr. Von Mirveld had already spent time and effort to prepare and file his opening brief in this case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that shouldn't have happened at all. Do you agree?
I would agree that yes, it would have been, in a perfect world, it would have been nice if we could have brought it to Mr. Williams' counsel's attention so that he couldn't have filed his opening brief. But notwithstanding that, it's likely that he still wouldn't have agreed that this was moot, as when I contacted him now, he still, you know, takes, and before the court takes the position that this is an active appeal and that the preliminary injunction order dissolving a preliminary, or I'm sorry, denying a preliminary injunction at the trial court should be reversed. But I do agree that in a perfect world, it would have been nice if Mr. Williams was advised more timely.
We're not talking about a perfect world. Don't the rules of civil procedure require that you notify all parties if there's a dismissal of the case?
Mr. Williams, in my understanding, there was no answer or appearance filed on behalf of Mr. Williams in the Rule 120 proceeding. There was a separate action, but in that proceeding, there was neither appearance nor answer were filed by Mr. Williams or his counsel. In terms of notice.
Okay, so from your perspective, you didn't have an obligation under the rules of civil procedure to advise either Mr. Williams or his attorney in this case?
Your Honor, because this is a Rule 120 proceeding and the requirements are somewhat different, I'm not particularly comfortable saying what the obligation is. I think that would have certainly been the right thing to do. It may have been the obligation as well.
Okay, thanks. I'm not trying to put you on the witness stand. I'm just trying to find out, you know, what happened and who knew what.
Sure. And I'm not trying to evade your questions in any way.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate it.
I have no further questions on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I want to start with there are a lot of issues raised by Mr. Williams in his opening brief and in the reply brief as well. So some hit during his argument and some not. So I want to try and maybe hit some of the ones he discussed. And please, I assume you'll stop me if you have other questions. Mr. Williams makes a number of different arguments related to the court's treatment of the Rule 120 proceeding, each of which Williams claims constitute reversible error. Williams claims that the trial court erred in giving preclusive effect to the Rule 120 proceeding, the failure of the court to consider the foreclosure defenses of waiver, estoppel, and real party and interest as defenses to the Rule 120 proceeding, and the court's taking judicial notice of certain facts as well. First, Williams claims that the trial court erred in finding that the order authorizing sale entered by Judge Kaplan in the Rule 120 proceeding precluded the granting of the preliminary injunction sought by Williams. It's our position that Williams' argument on this mistakes the finding which formed the basis of the trial court's ruling as to the rule of the Rule 120 in the trial court's decision. A review of the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law shows that the trial court really did not give preclusive effect to the 120 proceeding. Rather, the trial court pointed out that it was turning to the Rule of 120 proceeding because the allegations set forth by Williams in support of his motion in the pending action, the defenses of waiver, real party of interest, and estoppel, were defenses that would normally be asserted in a Rule 120 proceeding. While the trial court did state it was taking judicial notice of the filing of the complaint and of service and the grounds for default, it also went on to make, and I think this is an important thing, make its own findings as to default at service based upon the testimony given at the preliminary injunction hearing. with respect to the question of default, the trial court specifically stated that based on Williams' own testimony that he stopped making payments in August 2011, he was in default at the time the Rule 120 court entered the order authorizing sale. And then as to the issue of service, the trial court found that Williams testified he received notice of some sort on his door, and that while Williams could not say exactly what it was or when he got it, that it was enough for the court to determine that there was the probability of his claiming that insufficient service in the 120 case was not going to be sufficient to succeed on the merits.
Ms. Call, I'd like to ask you if you think that issues of estoppel and default and real party and interest can properly be raised in an action like this.
But I think they certainly can be raised here. Normally they would be raised in a 120 proceeding, and as counsel pointed out, you know, the a borrower or, you know, a debtor certainly has the right to bring his own independent action. The issue I think here is really how they're evaluated, and that's one of the issues that I see with this case is Mr. Williams is taking the point the trial court erred in not giving preclusive effect, the trial court here, but really it was, and in not considering this, but really it was Mr. Williams' burden to come forward and show entitlement to a preliminary injunction pursuant to the RAPKE elements.
I understand that, but I got the impression from your brief that your position was that a homeowner could not raise these issues at all in a separate proceeding, such as this case, but had to raise the issues only in the 120 proceeding. And what I hear you saying now is that my understanding was incorrect in that regard.
Well, I think, you know, they're more appropriately raised in a 120 proceeding, you know, as their defenses to a foreclosure action. I don't believe that there's anything barring them from being raised here, but I think if you're going to raise them, if a party's going to raise them, it isn't that, Deutsche Bank isn't the real party in interest, and then the burden shifts to Deutsche Bank to prove that it is in fact a real party in interest in the holder of the note deed of trust. That burden of showing real party in interest, if you're going to bring the lawsuit yourself, shifts to the party, the moving party, the party seeking the injunctive relief, which in this case would be Mr. Williams. I believe that's what I would, to the extent that I need to clarify, I believe that's our position with respect to that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Another issue that Mr. Williams alleges that the trial court erred with respect to the foreclosure, the trial court erred in taking judicial notice of the affidavit of service in the Rule 120 as to the Rule 120 notice of hearing, and further that the court improperly ruled on the affidavit to determine that Williams did in fact receive notice of the action. I don't think either party here disputes that Colorado Rule of Evidence 201 applies, and that the court may take judicial notice of the contents of the court records in a related proceeding, even when that proceeding was before another court, which is the case here. I'd also like to point out that a return of service constitutes prima facie evidence of the facts cited herein. And in this case, that's what the court did. They took judicial notice of the fact that it appeared that service had been done based on the return of service that was filed.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, if I might, Ms. Call. The rule, as I understand it, for taking judicial notice is that a court can take judicial notice of proceedings in another court case, but that a court may not take judicial notice of facts that are in dispute. Is that consistent with your understanding?
That is, Your Honor, but I don't believe that the issue of service is really a fact in dispute, per se, in this lawsuit.
Why not?
In the lawsuit seeks, you know, contains seven claims for relief, breach of contract, negligent misrepresentation, negligence. There isn't a claim for declaratory relief to set aside the foreclosure on the basis of lack of notice, and there isn't a wrongful foreclosure claim specifically. So I don't see that while service is referenced, and this, particularly in this appeal, that the trial court erred in taking judicial notice of, you know, service, I don't think that is a disputed fact in the case. You know, notwithstanding that, you know, I would point out that the court independently found, you know, as I referenced a few minutes ago, that Mr. Williams was in fact served by indicating that he did, in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, that he, a notice was posted on his door, and that while he wasn't clear as to exactly what it was or when it was posted, that he did receive nothing, and the court specifically stated that that was enough for her to find that service was proper.
Counsel, I want to switch gears with regard to the Rathke factors.
Yes.
The trial court stated or concluded that Williams has failed to demonstrate a reasonable probability of success on the merits of his claims, and five of the claims, the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, negligence, negligent hiring and supervision, negligence and misrepresentation, and violation of the CPA, stem from what you are telling us are oral promises to modify the loan. I'm sure you heard your counterpart get up and say that unlike any case he's seen before, and I think you represent he's done 20 of these, he's never seen a TPP that has been signed by the bank and produced. Does that not get them out of the statute of frauds issue here?
The fact that the TPP was signed, I don't necessarily think it takes him out of the credit agreement statute of frauds, but it was a little unclear in his argument. My understanding was that the TPP, everyone was in agreement that the trial period payment plan existed, and that it provided for free payments, and that the testimony, as I understood it, was that Deutsche Bank, or I'm sorry, its servicer was specifically stating or making comments to Mr. Williams that he, you know, would get a modification and so forth. I think the trial period payment plan was not an agreement. It was an agreement to agree, as the court indicated, and by its clear language, it states that it is not a modification, or it does not promise a modification. And I have that specific language. And I'm happy to share that with the court.
Well, apparently there's like language that leads to the inference that you just mentioned, and language that Mr. Von Meerhout cited that might lead to a different inference.
Yes, the language that I'm seeing referencing is in paragraph 2G of the trial period payment plan. It specifically states, I understand that this plan is not a modification of the loan documents, and that the loan documents will not be modified unless and until, one, I meet all of the conditions required for the modification, and two, I receive a fully executed copy of the modification agreement, and three, the modification effective date has passed. I further understand and agree that lender will not be obligated or bound to make any modification of the loan documents if the lender determines that I do not qualify or if I fail to meet any one of the requirements under this plan.
So why would the bank then return an executed copy if it hadn't concluded that the criteria were satisfied by Mr. Williams?
Well, to give him to, because the bank entered into, because the parties agreed to the trial period plan and it had previously forwarded them, it forwarded it to him, it would return an executed copy. I'm not sure how to answer the question exactly better than that.
Well, if I understand you correctly, then you're saying that the TPP was an agreement to agree, but it imposed no obligation whatsoever on Deutsche Bank because it was only an agreement to agree.
But it was an agreement to agree to accept the three payments at the modified rate and to review him for a modification. It was not an agreement to provide him with a permanent modification. It was an agreement to agree to in exchange for payment of a lesser payment of a month for a period of 3 months to allow him to be reviewed for a permanent modification.
And doesn't the fact that they signed 10 months after the initiation of this temporary plan that was only supposed to be in effect for 3 months, doesn't that at least give us some indicia that they were going forward with a modification, that the bank was going to modify?
I certainly see where you're coming from, and I suppose that it could. You know, I guess in answering that, it certainly could. At the end of the day, they didn't end up giving him a modification.
Excuse me, Ms. Call, I just realized that once again we have not abided by our ad hoc plan and we've gone over our time. So if you have a concluding statement, brief statement you'd like to make, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Sure, thank you. In this instance, the trial court was correct in finding that the preliminary injunction should be denied. Mr. Williams failed to demonstrate the RAFI elements, in particular likelihood of success on the merits, which would justify the issuance of a preliminary injunction. Accordingly, we would request that the trial court's order be upheld.
Thank you, Ms. Ball.
There was a comment made about that Mr. Williams, if the court dismisses this appeal, in the underlying action, he can always ask for an additional stay. Well, that's simply incorrect. The only way to stay a subsequent foreclosure proceeding is to seek an injunction, period, or to prevail at the Rule 120 hearing. All that the bank has to show is the court is well aware at a subsequent Rule 120 hearing is the a reasonable probability of a default under the loan. So, based on the district court's decision in this case, I don't believe we could refile a new preliminary injunction to stop a new foreclosure sale date from going forward. And, you know, it's my opinion that the second this court dismisses this appeal, if that's what it chooses to do, Deutsche Bank will file a new Rule 120 action, and Mr. Williams will be without any way of stopping that from going forward unless he prevails at the Rule 120 hearing. Okay. There's a bunch of legal argument made about Rule 120 actions. Frankly, none of that had anything to do with, or should not have had anything to do with, the judge's determination as to a reasonable probability of success on the merits of this case. The evidence, the undisputed evidence, showed at the hearing that the first non-payment was in August of 2011 after Deutsche Bank stopped accepting Mr. Williams' payments because he had been in default due to the trial period plan for well over 10 months. Each month he was paying that lesser amount was making him more and more in default. So he sends in his August 2011 payment for the full 2007 amount, which is $1,400 a month. He'd been doing that for about 6 months after Deutsche Bank told him that they would no longer offer another modification because they only approved one. Deutsche Bank wouldn't cash his check, sent back to him, and they've actually, in fact, already filed the NED notice with the public trustee in July of 2011 while he was still current with his payments based on their instructions. So the court made several incorrect findings based on judicial notice. She found that the Rule 120 action was not initiated until after Mr. Williams defaulted. It was, in fact, or stopped making payments because Deutsche Bank wouldn't accept them. They, in fact, initiated the foreclosure action while he was still making the 2007 modification payments per the instructions of Deutsche Bank. And then they refused to accept any further payment of the mortgage starting in August 2011.
Mr. Von Meerveld, your time has elapsed and then some, so if you want to make a concluding sentence or two, that's fine.
In order to ensure that Mr. Williams' property is not disposed of, which is an irreparable injury, we're talking about real property here, which is irreplaceable under Colorado law, the only remedy is for this court to overturn the district court's finding, which is incorrect as a matter of law, and require that a preliminary injunction stay to sell the property throughout the underlying litigation. Thank you.
Judge, I have one more question for him, though.
Sure. Who thought this was going to end early?
I don't understand why there couldn't be another Rule 20 and another preliminary injunction filed. I thought I heard you say a minute ago you don't believe that you could file a preliminary injunction, and I don't understand why that's so.
It's the same lawsuit. We're currently in this lawsuit. So my understanding is the argument is that I should somehow seek a stay in this lawsuit to prevent the sale from going forward. Well, currently, the law of the case is, if this court dismisses this appeal, is that the preliminary injunction did not meet the Rathke standards. So I don't know how I could file a new preliminary injunction without the court looking at me like I'm crazy and saying that's already been ruled on. So
okay, thank you.
Thank you both. We really appreciate your arguments on both the mootness and the merits. Mr. Von Mierveld, as I mentioned at the outset, we have talked about and would like you to file a written response to the motion to dismiss. I would ask that you do so within 7 days, and that it be a similar length to the response to the motion to dismiss filed by opposing counsel. I don't recall how many words that was, but something of comparable length would be appropriate.
Yes, sir.
And with that having been said, the case will be at issue, and a written opinion will issue in due course.